The infinite inning is the place where you question your courage. Imagine if you were on the 1947 Brooklyn Dodgers at spring training and Dixie Walker and some other players are circulating a petition saying that if an African-American player is added to the team, the rest of the players will strike. Do you punch Dixie in the nose? Do you tell Dixie to go to hell with that stuff? Do you go to Branch Rickey or Leo DeRocher? Or do you just sit quietly and wait for it to resolve? Remember, there's no union then, no contractual rights to be kept or paid by your current team or even to remain in the major leagues. You can be put on waivers, and if the team lets the word get around that you're a troublemaker, you will sail right on by, and it doesn't matter if you have incredible stats or you're a former MVP, you can be gone. Or think about even more difficult, perhaps. You're on the Yankees in the early 50s, and they haven't integrated at all. And what general manager George Weiss keeps saying is, we'd be happy to integrate, but we just cannot find. And we keep looking hither and yon under the sofa. We've pulled the corners of the rugs up, and yet there are no players of color who are up to the high standards that we have exhibited throughout the years. But you know that down in the minors, there is a player named Vic Power, Puerto Rican, of color, a first baseman with incredible range around the bag, who has spent the last 2 years at AAA and has hit 331 with 40 doubles, 17 triples, 16 home runs. That's a 553 slugging percentage. And then kept there because there was nowhere else for him to go, given that the Yankees are just not going to promote him. He hit 349. And again, 39 doubles, 10 triples, 16 home runs, 521 slugging percentage. Any other player in most other organizations would have been promoted. And everyone is aware of this. And organizations like the NAACP are watching the Yankees and saying, well, what are they going to do? They have literally no rationale for keeping this guy off the team. They were boxed in, and so they traded him to the A's. And this is the trade, and I'm purposely not going to give you the background of the other names. But on December 16th, 1953, Vic Power was traded with Don Bullweg, Jim Finnegan, Johnny Gray, Bill Renna, Jim Robertson, and $25,000 to the A's for Lauren Babe, Harry Bird, Tom Hamilton, Carmen Morrow, and Eddie Robinson. And if you haven't seen the numbers of any of those gentlemen retired and hanging on the walls of Yankee Stadium, that is because they did absolutely nothing to earn that. The trade was a meaningless trade in terms of talent. It was consummated strictly to get Power out of town. The newspapers were full of outrage at that point, but as far as I know, no Yankee spoke up and derided the move. Did Yogi Berra, Billy Martin, Phil Rizzuto? Hank Bauer, very outspoken guy, ex-Marine Hank Bauer, Mickey Mantle, just 21 years old, but still, he knew right from wrong. Whitey Ford, Eddie Lopat, Vic Rashi, Allie Reynolds. Allie Reynolds, a Native American, knew something about discrimination. I don't think they did. And the reason that they didn't was simply this. They would have been traded. Again, they had no rights. And if you were a Yankee, and veteran Yankees would tell young Yankees this, I figure World Series shares into my budget for the year. I am underpaid being with this organization, but they make it up to me because we play in October every year, and I get a share of that sweet World Series money, so don't screw it up for me. Well, if you stood up for Vic Power or for a more egalitarian form of baseball that included all races as long as they had the talent to play, you might, as Power did, get exiled to the A's or the Browns or something like that. And so you kept quiet if you cared at all. And that's shameful, and I don't excuse it, but you can understand the thought process that lies behind someone's self-interest, if in fact there was anyone on the Yankees at that time who had an enlightened view of the whole thing. But we also know that self-interest extended to integration because on one hand, a player in his private life might have conducted his business in a completely equitable fashion, a colorblind fashion, but what a lot of ball players were thinking and said, including some of those same Dodgers I was just talking about, was they are coming for our jobs. And so bravery took a backseat to venality. Similarly, I've always given Ted Williams a lot of credit for using part of his Hall of Fame induction speech to advocate for the Negro League players who were so injured by the color line to be included in the Hall of Fame. And yet, I also think that Ted Williams spent his entire career playing for Tom Yawkey, one of the architects of that policy, one of the people dedicatedly upholding it, and the owner of the organization that clung to it for the longest. And I think, where the hell was Ted Williams before he retired? Where was he in all those years from when he came up in 1939 through Pumpsy Green? And I suspect the answer is something similar. He didn't want to rock the boat for himself. These thoughts came to mind for me recently when I failed a very minor version of that test. I was at one of my doctor's offices, and I was in the intake part of what is usually a long afternoon. There were two nurses working on me at the outset of the appointment, and for you to understand why I have some misgivings about this experience, I have to detail the race of each nurse. On my right hand, there was a Caucasian nurse who was grabbing my arm and taking my blood pressure and stuff, and on my left hand was an African-American nurse who was sitting at a computer and asking me questions about my medical history and what drugs I'm on and so forth. All of them, as it turns out. So the Caucasian nurse got the results of my blood pressure, and it was kind of high, and I was very stressed. And she said, "Do you often read high?" And I said, "Yeah, I have a touch of white coat syndrome. I read lower at home, but as soon as I get into a doctor's office, it pops up." And she said, "Okay, well, we'll take it again. But I want you to be calm. I want you to relax. I want you to go to a happy place. Don't think about white coats. Don't look at me." And then she pointed to her colleague and said, "Think of her. She doesn't have any white in her." And the thought went through me very, very quickly. Did I just hear that? Did she just say that? And my jaw hinged a couple of times. And what I said was, "Wow." And I glanced from one nurse to the other, and neither seemed to think that anything interesting had been said or out of line. The African-American nurse seemed totally unmoved, and so I just let them move me on, and I thought, maybe this is their relationship, maybe this is the sort of office where you can say things like that. But wait, in this day and age, is there any office in which you can say things like that, even jokingly? That's not a joke. And I was just so perplexed that I let them move me on to the rest of the appointment. And at one point, I had wanted to say to the doctor, "Listen, this uncomfortable thing happened." But I didn't. I got caught up in my own medical stuff. And what I also should have done and didn't think about until I was back in my car was I should have gone back to that nurse, not the one who made the crack, but the one who was the recipient of it, and said, "Listen, that really bugged me, and I don't mean to start trouble, but if you want to make a complaint about that, I'd be happy to back you up." But of course, I didn't do that either. So I'm a big hero, and an eloquent one, too. I mean, given a moment to be, I don't know, Patrick Henry, I said, "Wow." And that wow contained a lot. It just contained my shock and my astonishment that somebody would make a joke like that in this day and age. But still, it's not something to be proud of. It was easier in the end to pretend that it hadn't happened, that I must have misunderstood it some way. And I think white players in the age of integration were probably like that too. Take the Vic Powers story that I alluded to a few minutes ago. The trade was so transparent that when Elston Howard had a big year at AAA in Toronto in 1954, he hit .330 with 22 home runs. The Yankees had absolutely no choice but to add him to the major league team. And it was very good for them that they did, because he was an excellent player for a long time, and almost certainly a far better one than he looked, because he was a right-handed hitter in Yankee Stadium. And the point of this is not to get into Elston Howard's stats, but I can't resist noting that in his career he hit 53 home runs in Yankee Stadium, 114 every place else. And between that and the fact that his major league career didn't get started until he was 26 because of the organization's prejudice against his skin tone, he paid a pretty severe price for being under contract to the Yankees. Conversely, he helped them get to 9 World Series, and at the end of his career, when he was traded over to the Red Sox, he helped them get to a World Series too. And at the risk of being overly simplistic about the whole deal, it seems to me that there are those among us who are more concerned with what a person looks like or where they come from than what they can do. And that is one of the most basic logical errors out there. It is, almost literally, judging a book by its cover, and that's something that we're warned not to do from infancy onward. And what makes me feel worse about both the period that I'm discussing, in which so many white players went along to get along, and my failure to follow up on this weird little exchange in the doctor's office is that when people have that limited way of judging others, it's very easy to be a Panglossian racist, which is to say, in this best of all possible worlds, all is for the best if Elston Howard makes the Yankees, or because Elston Howard made the Yankees, or if the nurse in my doctor's office didn't break down and cry in front of me. I see no damage, therefore there is no damage. But you can't make that assumption. So for every ball player or baseball executive at the time who looked at the Vic Power Elston Howard situation and said, hey, the system sort of worked, the NAACP got involved, and the Yankees ultimately added their one guy, everything is the way it should be, you're looking at people through the wrong end of the telescope. All the success of an Elston Howard means is that he's the sole survivor who escaped your dismissal of his entire group. And that goes for Latino ball players, and it goes for Asian ball players, or whoever is the out group at a given moment. And that goes for people in our society as well who are not part of baseball but might be dismissed for other reasons. The industrious immigrant in your community that you acknowledge is not an exception to anything except the blanket of your prejudice. And so, when you don't do your part, when you say, oh, well, the Elston Howards of the world, those situations, they take care of themselves, and the group as a whole must be okay, so therefore I don't need to speak up. You've abdicated your own responsibility to participate and stand up for what is right. I'm Stephen Goldman, and this is the Infinite Inning Baseball Podcast. Patachi's RPM pizza is always the same. Get it in 33 and a third minutes, or it's free. When Jimmy, your regular pizza delivery boy, knocks on the door at 34 and a third minutes, you insist on receiving your pie gratis. But please, no, Jimmy says. There were potholes. I busted an axle. No, no, you say. A deal is a deal. And you holster your wallet. But Mr. Patachi, he beats me. You harden your heart. But I need the money. He docks me. I'm working my way through the Institute of Probabilistic Studies, and this is my tuition money. But no, you remain steadfast in your demand for a cost-free pizza. Reluctantly, Jimmy agrees. The hot box in your hands, you turn from the door. When it rings again, you open it. Jimmy, I told you. He's standing there with another pizza. I never want to be late for you again, he says. So I used my advanced probability calculator to determine when you would next order a pizza and what kind. This is it. You will order it 2.5 weeks from today. Confused, you still refuse to pay, and Jimmy says, no problem, I'll add it to your tab. 10 minutes later, the doorbell rings again. You open it. It's Jimmy with three more pies. Covering, he insists, the next three orders that you will place, and insists that you take them, once again adding the fee to your tab. This continues for the next 10 days. You arrive home from work and there are pizzas piled on your doorstep. You settle in to sleep for the night and there is Jimmy with more hot pies. Your house is filling up with pizzas. On the 11th day, Mr. Patachi and a large man he refers to as Bruno the Dog appear on your doorstep demanding payment of the $15,000 pizza debt that Jimmy has run up on your behalf. You beg for time and he accedes, but vows to return. That evening, Jimmy shows up with 17 more probabilistic pizzas, and you conclude that you have to kill him. At that moment, the doorbell rings, and forgetting yourself, you throw it open and say, damn it, Jimmy, I told you, and Jimmy shoots you. Yeah, he says, I calculated you were going to do that too. And as you fade from this world, you realize you never should have started with Patachi's Pizza RPM. You should have stuck to healthier foods, like episode 37. Don't forget to hold the mushrooms. Welcome back to the show. It's good to be talking to you. Today, I'm joined by Dan Zimborski, ESPN baseball analyst and the creator of the Zips baseball projection system, which forecasts what players are going to do in the coming season. These are rolling out on Fangraphs right now, one team at a time. And we talk about the art of forecasting, what the systems can know and what they don't know, and what happens when users hold the projections against you, among many other things. Before we bring on Dan, and before the rolling power failures my section of the happiest place on earth, by which I mean New Jersey, seems to be enjoying today, I wanted to return briefly to the topic I broached last week when I talked about Red Ruffing in World War II and how one of the consequences of the war was that this guy who was pushing 40 got pulled away from his family and his career for a couple of years. I promise that next week I'll move on to some other time period for a while, but I've still had this on my mind, even though the intermittent martial drumbeat has quieted some this week in favor of other controversies. But I keep thinking about this story, this comic book story. It was, I think, published by DC Comics in Our Fighting Forces number 10, 1956, and the cover feature is called Grenade Pitcher. According to the Grand Comics Database, which is a tremendously fun site to go through if you haven't done it, that story has never been reprinted, but I swear I've read it. The story is about how a major league pitcher goes into the service in World War II and is just an ace throwing grenades because of his experience in the big leagues. The story has always bugged me because throwing a baseball and throwing a hand grenade are not the same thing. I mean, just to pick one small detail, a World War II era pineapple hand grenade weighed about a pound and a half, or about a full pound more than a baseball does. Today, the hand grenades, as I understand it, are a bit lighter, just under a pound. But if Clayton Kershaw is drafted and tries to pitch a hand grenade at 95 miles an hour, he's going to shred his shoulder. He's going to yank it right out of the socket. I just hope we never have to find out. The story really should have been grenade outfielder, because I imagine that when a right fielder makes that big heave to home plate, that's closer to the whole grenade thing. Maybe Yasiel Puig would have been better in that story. You could kind of see it. Yasiel Puig pegging grenades at the Wehrmacht. Or maybe Puig would have held the grenade too long and blown himself up. Again, it would be better not to find out. Fortunately, ballplayers did other things in the service besides throw hand grenades. Sometimes they buzzed major league stadiums. One of the great moments, I think, in baseball history in a weird sort of way, happened on June 27th, 1943, when outfielder Buddy Lewis took his C-47 cargo plane and came in low over his teammates at Griffith Stadium in Washington. The world was at war, the outcome was still in doubt, the Senators had been dispersed, and who knew when they'd be together again. And yet, here was this gesture of bravado. They were all in it together somehow, both on the ground with bats and gloves and in the air. And it's significant that it was Buddy Lewis who made that gesture, because after the war, he wasn't nearly as spirited. He and his teammate Cecil Travis are probably the two players who were most affected by the war in terms of getting knocked off of a Hall of Fame trajectory. Travis, a shortstop, missed all of 1942 through 1944 and all but 15 games of 1945. He went from his age 27 season to his age 31 season before he got another major league at bat. When he left, he was a .327 career hitter, and when he came back, he just didn't have the same capabilities. And a lot of accounts like to say that he fought in the Battle of the Bulge, which of course took place in winter, and he got frostbite on his toes and just wasn't the same athlete afterward. But he always denied that. He just said that it had been too long. He couldn't get it going again. That is a long layoff, 4 whole years. Lewis didn't have the same problem. He did get it going again. Just the joy of it was gone for him. Lewis's stats don't do him justice for a number of reasons. One is the ballpark. It's hard to think of a comp because he played at Griffith Stadium, which was just this extreme pitcher's park. So in his career, he had 71 home runs, 54 on the road, 17 at home. But beyond that, he came up at 18, and he didn't really hit his full stride for a few years. So in the 3 years before he had to leave for the war, 1939 through 1941, when he was 22, 23, and 24, he hit 311, 393 on base, 451 slugging, playing both right field and third base. Accounts of his defense at third vary. And when he left, because he had come up so young and done so well, he had 1,112 career hits. Pete Rose had 518 at the same age. I'm not saying that Lewis would have had 4,000 hits necessarily, but had the war not happened and his career had something like a regular progression, it seems likely he would have had a very high total. Jose Altuve, who seems as much of a lock for 3,000 hits as a 27-year-old can be, had only 630 hits through age 24, so Lewis nearly doubled him up. He was taken into the Army Air Force right after Pearl Harbor, and as I said, he flew C-47 transport planes, which doesn't sound glamorous, but was actually quite daring because of where he did it. He was part of a massive effort to keep China in the war by supplying Chiang Kai-shek's nationalist army with lend-lease equipment and weapons. And the way this was done, it couldn't be done by sea because the Japanese controlled the China coast and a good deal inland. And the supplies couldn't be driven in, at least initially, because the Japanese had conquered Burma and the British were doing kind of a desultory job of getting it back. And the United States didn't really want to support them in that anyway, at least not with a big commitment of resources. But at the same time, they felt it was important to keep China in the war on two levels. One, because Franklin Roosevelt perceived this big post-war role for China in world affairs, which he was right. He was a little ahead of things, but he was right. Just wrong about who it would be with. It would be with Mao Zedong and the communists, not with Chiang Kai-shek's very corrupt nationalist government. And also because, militarily, the more resistance the Chinese put up in their own country, the more resources the Japanese had to commit, and that meant that those soldiers and goods couldn't be used against us as we hopped from island to island across the Pacific, making our way to the Japanese home islands. So the way that they got these supplies in was to fly them from India via these transport planes over what was called the hump. You went over the Himalayas, flying on oxygen at high altitudes, and then landed in China. We had local air superiority, so although there were fighter attacks, that wasn't the big deal. It was the weather, it was the altitude, it was the takeoffs and landings, and there was some other harrowing stuff, because it sounds like a war divorced from carnage, but it wasn't. When Lewis came back to the Senators about halfway through 1945, he hit very well, and he hit well in 1946 too, but in 1947, injuries started to wear him down, and he said, "I'm just not into it, I've seen too much in the war," and he retired. There was an abortive comeback in 1949, but at that point he was at best a fourth outfielder, and he quit for good. He was 32. And I wondered what someone with his wartime experience might have seen, given that, in theory, he was flying from a place in India that, except for one Japanese thrust at that area, was mostly outside of the combat zone, and landing well behind the lines in China as well. So what about that experience would separate a young man from his joy in playing baseball? First of all, the flying itself was hazardous. In Michael Pearson's book on the Burma Air Campaign, titled The Burma Air Campaign, he talks about how the weather was so extreme and so random that it made flying very dangerous. Quote, "On one memorable occasion, observers watched a Dakota transport aircraft fly into thunderclouds, only to emerge some minutes later, traveling in the opposite direction, upside down. In the turbulence of the cloud formation, the pilot lost all control of the aircraft." Now, for all we know, that was Buddy Lewis. But I think the bigger part is this. And what I'm going to say now is a book or 10 in itself, and so my describing it in roughly 90 seconds is not going to remotely do it justice, but hopefully you get the picture. Burma was a sideshow to the bigger show of the war. And when I tell you that over 100,000 Japanese died to defend their purchase on Burma, it doesn't mean that it wasn't a sideshow. It just means that the overall war was disgustingly, hideously, deadly for millions, so 100,000 is a paltry figure in context. It was jungle fighting, which nobody wanted to do. Not the American government, not the British government, not really. Certainly not with large bodies of men. They didn't really know how to deploy large bodies of men in the jungle that way. They also had other priorities, namely Europe and the island-hopping campaign in the Pacific. At the same time, they wanted to open what was called the Burma Road, this 700-mile path into the back of China, for lend-lease equipment so that they were not wholly dependent on air transport. And someone got the bright idea that even if they didn't have whole armies at their disposal to fight the Japanese Empire, they could be really disruptive with commandos. The British had a crazy general named Wingate, who started a unit. It was officially called the Long Range Penetration Unit, or something vaguely pornographic like that, but in practice they called themselves the Chindits. And the Chindits were these hit-and-run guerrillas that would materialize out of the jungle and blow some stuff up and disappear again. But they suffered tremendous attrition rates, in part because Wingate had decreed that the wounded could not be carried out. They would have to be executed by their own side. And what they accomplished, in the grand scheme of things, was probably not that big a deal. But it was very popular in the press. And the Americans thought, we want to do that too. That's really cool. We need our own commandos. And we started a unit codenamed Galahad, but called Merrill's Marauders for their commanding general. This was about 3,000 troops, and it really was, notwithstanding the number, kind of a dirty dozen situation where they took all the wretched refuse from the rest of the army and sent it into the jungles in China and Burma. The thing was, though, that eventually they needed commandos less than they needed a conventional unit. And so they had to throw Merrill's Marauders into some battles against the whole Japanese army. And they did tremendously well, given that they were neither equipped nor trained for that kind of operation. But the toll was incredible. And not only were Merrill's Marauders destroyed as an effective fighting force from the combat, they also picked up things like amoebic dysentery from their time in the jungle. And to add a third level to it, American planners had decided that they didn't really need adequate food supplies on any given day, that they would kind of go through life on the equivalent of bread and water. And so you had this understrength group punching above their weight against a superior force. They are not being fed, and they are pooping themselves to death. And that sounds funny, but if you read anything about amoebic dysentery, you know that it is the furthest thing from funny, and it is only out of respect for your sense of delicacy that I am not describing the whole thing in its bloody excretory detail. This can kill you, and in incredibly unpleasant ways. But wait, there's more. As those soldiers became injured or too ill to fight and were taken off the line, American generals insisted that they had to go back because the situation was too dire to do without them. That was both a military and a political decision, because we had to say to Chiang Kai-shek, keep throwing Chinese soldiers at this. Look what we're doing to our own guys. So they were kind of sacrificial lambs. Hey man, sorry, you may not be able to hold your guts together right now, but you're going back into the thick of it. Well, who do you think shuttled Merrill's Marauders in and out of those battles? That's right, Buddy Lewis and his C-47 transport plane. What he saw when he took those guys off the battlefield, and what he must have felt when he brought them back, I'm not sure there are words for whatever that feeling must be. How many men died on the deck of his plane? If you have been fortunate enough in your life to have known some World War II veterans, or if you've read about them in the aftermath of the war, they weren't sad all the time, they didn't brood all the time, just now and again. And imagine the quiet hours. Imagine that you're standing out in right field, and it's peaceful, and the other team, like in the Peter, Paul, and Mary song, are just composed of righties who don't hit the ball your way. Then your mind might wander, and I could see why you would want to occupy your time with anything else but that. And so for now, we'll leave the thought that we began here last week with Red Ruffing. But just remember that these two stories, Ruffing and Lewis, they're not baseball stories. They're stories that happen to have baseball players in them, but they're tales of any young men who had the course of their lives diverted by the actions of statesmen, politicians, and bandits, madmen and heroes. We know about their stories because they were ballplayers, but they just as easily could have been any one of us. And while I let that thought sit with you, we'll pause for a word from our sponsors. I'll be back with Dan Szymborski in just a moment. This winter has been so slow that many teams are still dwelling in the past, but my next guest is already forecasting their future. He's been an analyst for ESPN going back to 2010, and he is the creator of the Zips Forecast, which have been running on Fangraphs for the past 5 years. He's Dan Szymborski. How are you, Dan?
Pretty good. How are you today, Steve?
I'm good. I'm functional and I'm indoors, so I'm warm. This is going to sound like a terrible segue, but it's true. When I look at your forecasts, I almost get a hint of spring because we're looking at actual baseball numbers. And yes, they're hypothetical baseball numbers, but they're baseball numbers that are going to actually start getting generated under the warm Florida and Arizona suns in spring training and afterward. Do you have like an emotional reaction to them?
Well, one thing I like about doing the projections is I like, because, you know, some people, when they do projections, they just run them all, release them all, and that's it. I like just slowly teasing and rolling them out because it gives me different things to write about and just different things to talk about, especially when we have an off season like this one where we go weeks without any real actual news. So I do like the rollouts. It actually feels like spring where I am. I'm in Ohio at the moment, and it's in the 50s after being like negative 10 last week. So if I go outside, I'm probably going to wear shorts.
It's still cold here in the East, so I'm quite jealous. Now, I want to ask you one question. Before I ask you how one's career path brings them to being an ESPN analyst and somebody who does these highly regarded projections, I want to ask you about my one personal connection to the whole projection business, which is this, that I edited or co-edited something like 7 or 8 editions of the Baseball Prospectus Annual. And those, of course, used Nate Silver's Pecota projections. Mm-hmm. My first year editing the book, the publisher said, we need some kind of catchy slogan to describe Pecota for the cover. And we batted around a few things. And I said, and to my eternal regret and amusement, said, how about deadly accurate Pecota projections? And yeah. I thought this was like a hyperbolic, silly, joking kind of thing. But a lot of people got really pissed off with that. And this may be the first time I publicly admitted that. I might have said it somewhere, social media, someplace, that I came up with that. No one gets irony, I guess. But did you have that kind of reaction when we did that?
Not really, because I tend to take everything as a joke. That's just my personality. I don't really take that much all that seriously. I just thought it was one of the things that it's more fun to tease you guys about than actual make fun of. Kind of like I will harass Dave Cameron about number 6 organization with the Mariners from a few years ago, and I'll make number 6 jokes. But since I know him well, he doesn't take offense to that, like some stranger yelling at him, number 6 org. So I do like things. I tend to be very self-deprecating when I describe Zips. I always tell people my goal is to have the least terrible way of predicting the future, which obviously I don't think that the corporate people trying to sell that would be that happy with.
But I think that's fair in a way, right? Because periodically people will write articles that compare one system to another. It seems like they all kind of ballpark around the same place. Is that fair, or is there one that is deadly accurate compared to the others?
It is absolutely fair, because we've pretty much gotten all the low-hanging fruit. As much as we have lots of cool data and stuff that's out there, it's only refining the projections a little. Because of the similarity of projections, what I focused on is having Zips be incredibly flexible. And I can do things like careers, or ask what's the probability of X player hitting 35 home runs at least in 6 years. So I've been focusing on things like career projections. I did the in-season projections. I was the first on that one, I think. So I try to make something that's useful for people and that can tell a lot of stories in a lot of ways, because it is hard when all the best projection systems are essentially for their mean bottom line projection in the same range.
Now, do you have false starts with this? Because one of the things that was always fun for me when we were putting the annual together was that Nate's system, and you have to keep in mind that back when I was doing this, and Nate was still doing it before he had moved on to electoral politics and those kinds of things. He was running it on an old Timex Sinclair or Commodore 64 or something very antiquated. It basically lived in a spreadsheet. So first of all, a run took like 3 days. So if there was a problem and we were pushing the deadline, it was a very scary thing to note errors. But occasionally, I guess he would have given it the wrong input or something would have gone awry. So we'd have weird artifacts like every hitter coming out with the same number of home runs initially, or the first year that we started to list the top three player comps for each player based on his statistical profile, the initial run, and I will never forget this because as well-versed as I am in the baseball encyclopedia or now baseball reference, I was not familiar with this player. The top comparable for every single pitcher was a 1950s Reds pitcher named Herm Wehmeyer, who has no significance whatsoever, except that for whatever reason, Pakoda glommed onto him. And of course, we went back and we corrected that and we got a better run. But do you ever have off results like that where you have to redo it?
Well, the nice thing is about doing team by team rundowns is I don't finalize my projections for the year until I hit a team. So when you're going about 80 names at a time over a 3 month period, you tend to find issues pretty quickly, so you don't have that same problem. I mean, there are some players that do come up a lot in comparables, not to the extent where they happen every time, but some of the people who are just kind of generically average or generically mediocre tend to pop up, like Chad Mueller. He tends to be on the comp list for a lot of those mediocre 32, 33-year-old catchers who are kind of AAA veterans. They all seem to get Chad Mueller somewhere in their massive list. I mean, I've had some errors before. Sometimes I accidentally added, must have hit something on my keyboard because 1 year Jose Molina, I wasn't looking. The projection came out with a 1300 slugging percentage, which happened because there was an extra seven before his home runs. So he's projected to hit like 76 home runs in 85 at bats. And I was getting an error for the war because something was, there was some issue coming up with some divide by zero somewhere once it figured out there were more home runs than plate appearances or something. So you do have those things pop up. I'm pretty good at catching them. When I run final projections, I'm very careful. I look at it and I like having Steamer around just because if something pops up and I see that Zips has project someone for like an ERA 3 runs a game better than Steamer, I could say, oh, wait, maybe I should double check this, because if Steamer thinks that differently than Zips on this player, that there, I want to make sure that that's what Zips is saying. So there's ways to error correct, going slowly and having other resources just to do kind of the idiot check. It is pretty helpful. You guys didn't have that available, you know, in that point in time.
Back in the pioneer days. For people who don't know, when you compare Zips to Steamer or Zips to the other systems, what is the difference between those various systems?
That of course is a tricky question, simply because I know all the ins and outs in Zips, but Jared Cross and those guys who do Steamer, they're not exactly going to volunteer all the innards to me, even if I can kind of guess broadly how they work. And things like certain kinds of players projecting differently, that kind of calibration error has been mostly ironed out of the projection system. So it's hard to say like this projection system is better for under 25 or this system is better for like old players or fast players. A lot of that kind of calibration has already been solved. So it's really hard to say exactly how Steamer differs. It would just be a complete guess on my part, which I hate to do.
But it's fair to say that we've moved way beyond, say, the period I'm talking about now, going back to Bill James in the 1980s, when a projection system was just, we'll take the three most recent years, we'll weight the most recent year most heavily and the first year least heavily and kind of average it out. And that's what we'll guess the guy is going to do going forward.
Yeah, we're beyond that, although it is a part of it still. The very, you know, the basic fundamental, like the whole, when you're developing like a baseline projection, on some level, that's like a starting point in a way. You do a lot more than that, but it's kind of the starting point of that. And I know it's the starting point of Steamer, because one thing I do know is that they initially started with Marcel and worked from there. And Marcel does that. It's like looking at a car. There are a lot of things that are modern, but some of the very basic things are still what they've been for decades and decades. even if we've improved considerably on that.
So how do you approach it? And I know your Yankees projections are already out, where you have a player like Aaron Judge who took this quantum leap forward, and you don't have the 3-year base or even really the minor league track record on which to work out of, off of, you just have this massive season and a weird season with the relatively high batting average for the number of strikeouts and everything. And now you have to project going forward. It seems to me like your information is not wholly complete going in.
Yeah, and that's one thing you have to kind of accept, that you never get as good information as you'd like. You never have a larger cohort of comparable players in baseball history to compare to, because that approach is good, but you kind of run into problems with extreme players of all types, the guys who explode suddenly or the guys who are just like Barry Bonds, is that all we know about baseball is from baseball history. There's no experimental data. We can only compare to things that are happening or things that have happened. And that's really our only way to contextualize things that happen. A lot of times you can say, you know, the data isn't as good as we'd like, and there's not much we can do about it. We're just going to have to accept a larger error bars for these projections. And it's frustrating, but there's not much you can do about it. I can't, you know, put Aaron Judge in a lab and make him play a million seasons because, you know, science and feasibility and the players union would be upset about that. Projections really are making the best of what data we have, and sometimes it's just not very good.
Well, that brings up an interesting question, and it was something that came to mind actually in an article that was linked off of the post for the Royal Zips. It was another Fangraphs article in which, and the name of the author is escaping me at the moment, but another Fangraphs author had been trying to kind of average out first basemen who were in kind of the Eric Hosmer family of first basemen, and he used a population that went back to 1947, and he got a lot of disparate players. He was looking for guys who hit their peak the same age that Hosmer did in 2017. But it seems to me that if you go back that far, you have a lot of different kinds of baseball. You're post-integration, but integration didn't happen all at once. It happened haltingly, and so you didn't necessarily have the fully developed field of talent that we have now. The strike zone went up and down and in and out. The mound went up and down. Like, a whole lot of things changed. So where do you draw the line in terms of sucking people into this pool of comparables, if that's the right term, where somebody's numbers from, say, you know, 1930 may lead you down the wrong path?
Well, one thing I did is when I was developing my version of the whole cohort type thing that Nate did, and the Elias Baseball Analyst actually did in the 80s too, kind of rudimentary, but the same kind of concept, is, I mean, I went back and I saw at what point do these comparables make projections worse. And I actually had a cutoff period at the dead ball era, that before the dead ball era, it was so different that even adjusting, say, how many standard deviations above the mean some player's home run total was, even doing stuff like that didn't really compensate just for the difference in how baseball was played. What it's come down to is, since then, these older similarity scores for players, it still helps the projections. So when Zips looks back, it looks back through baseball history to the end of the dead ball era, and then as many minor league years as I have. I've been slowly doing translations for the minors. Zips now looks at minor league players up into the late 60s now. So that's what I have so far. Eventually, I'd like to expand that, study more, see how far the minors go back in this kind of utility, because just like baseball's different, the minors are different from what they used to be. So it's always an interesting challenge, and you always try to seek more data. But as I mentioned, there is a cutoff, and it does appear to be the dead ball era.
So if you assimilated that kind of minor league information, the thing that just popped into my head were years like in the Pacific Coast League in the 20s, where they played 200 games and Tony Lazzari hit 60 home runs over 200 games. I mean, I guess you can prorate that to 162, right? And then it wouldn't be a problem.
Well, you have to see about that. I'm not that far back. Since I'm only in the 60s, I'm not at a point yet where the minors are drastically different. I don't know what's going to happen when we get to the early days of the minors with, you know, 75 levels and just all sorts of craziness down there. But it's fun because you can look at some of those players and play what if games. But it'll be a while until I'm thinking about the 20s and 30s and 40s.
Along those lines, and I'd plan to ask you this later, but since we're back there now, given what your system knows, would you be comfortable just as an academic exercise, say, going back to somebody like Ted Williams and filling in the years that he missed to military service or that Joe DiMaggio did, and then giving kind of a hypothetical career projection had they not gone off to serve?
I'm actually comfortable because for a few reasons. One, I actually have done Ted Williams. I don't have it in front of me, but I did do it. I did a kind of an experiment where what would he have to hit during World War II for the projections to match what he did coming back, which was a fun little experiment. So I had done those things. And the nice thing about doing those is you're comfortable with it because you know that you're never really going to be proven wrong. If I make a crazy projection for 2018, let's say I project Willie Calhoun to hit 75 home runs. When 2018 passes and he doesn't hit 75 home runs and he hits 25 home runs, people will be able to note that and make fun of me. But when I do something like I project Eric Davis healthy, I did that once. I did a full career for Al Rosen, things like that. Since that's never actually going to happen, and if we do have a time machine, there's probably more things you need to do than to make Ted Williams play baseball. So I don't think that I'm likely to be proven wrong. It's just fun. And for something that's fun, I don't mind if it's not as good as not as predictable as I'd like it to be. Just for fun, in a chat thing online, someone asked me last was really bothering me last week and says, can you project Rafael Palmeiro in 2018? And of course, my first reaction was, you know, Zips is not really designed for players that are taking off for more than a decade. I don't think a projection system really tells me much about how he would hit. And of course, the reaction is, well, can you do it anyway? So I said, fine. And I went in and I looked at Palmeiro and it gave, I mean, a pretty poor projection for Palmeiro. I am actually pulling it up. It projected him to get 130 at bats, hit 164, 187 on base percentage, 194 slugging percentage. I have no idea that's right.
Ouch.
Yeah, I mean, he's 53 and he hasn't played in what, 13 years, something like that. It's been a very long time. So it's probably not going to happen that I'm going to get proven wrong, but it was fun to look at it. And one of the reasons I do this job is I have fun doing it. I love baseball and I love answering questions about history and the future and all that. So I will do some of these things, even if they're not quite as mathematically justifiable as other things are.
We talked before about not having as much information as you would like on the beginning of a player's career, such as Aaron Judge, with which to make a projection. But Palmeiro is a very extreme example of this. But I would think the 40-year-old player is also a similar thing, because every player who has a great year at an old age is still heading for a cliff. You just don't know where that cliff is for him. And I suppose that's true of every player. But if, say, David Ortiz were to come back, or even if David Ortiz had played last year, whereas in 2016, he had one of the great seasons ever by a 40-year-old player and probably the best season ever that anyone retired off of. But how confident, and I assume you did project him just for the heck of it, but I mean, how confident would you have been in that projection given that at 40, it could be that would have been the year that his reflexes went? Or Willie Mays after 1971. Willie Mays had a 6.3 war as per Baseball Ref at age 40 in 1971, and that was it. He dropped off right after that.
They're definitely increased error bars when you look at that, when you look at a 40-year-old compared to a 30-year-old. It doesn't actually tend to be quite as bad as when you're talking about prospects, simply because with prospects, you never really know if they're going to develop, because people generally overrate the probability that a prospect will improve and develop. People think that they all have these neat aging curves where they go up to 27 and then they slowly go back down. But a lot of guys in the minors and the ones that don't make the majors are just the ones that never improve. So when you're projecting a young player, you're projecting a player that might improve and might not. When you're projecting an old player, you don't necessarily know the year that they're going to collapse, but you know at some point time's going to win. There's no player where time is just not going to win. So it's like projecting, it's like selling life insurance to 95-year-olds. It's hard to tell if they're going to die this year, but they are going to die in the not too distant future. So the projections aren't that bad. The actuarial numbers for them aren't not that bad compared to, say, a younger person. I guess it's more difficult, but it's not impossible.
You know, you mentioned Chad Muller before as kind of your generic backup catcher. And there's kind of a rule of backup catchers, and I don't think you can ever fault a projection system for this, but you know that every backup catcher will have that Rick Cerrone 1980 year or some year where it just be some combination of luck and the playing time that they will have a 250 to 350 at bat season where they will just hit 320 that year. And maybe the rest of the time they were a horrible offensive player, but for that, you know, Sandy Leone, the year before last, with the production that he had for the, like, what, third of a season that he had for the Red Sox, there's no way for you to capture that, really, is there?
Not really. You know, there's a good chance that you're going to be wrong, but it's always hard to tell what year it's going to happen. Catchers are in particular more difficult than players in other positions. You look at, like, catching prospects, and there's so many just young catchers that have had just oddball pass to the majors that you don't really see with like a first base prospect. And if you think how many interesting young catchers have just burnt out quickly, it is a challenge with catchers. But it's funny about Chad Muller that every veteran catcher gets him somewhere on his cohorts. And there's like a player like that for every position, especially when they tend to be fairly nondescript at the distribution of their abilities. For like mediocre center fielders, the patron saint tends to be Herm Winningham. But Chad Muller had his moments too. It's not like he never made the majors. I mean, he had a 10-year major league career. And even he had the year where he had like the 900 OPS, I think, one of those Diamondbacks years.
You know, I remember Herm Winningham very, very well. I was, 12, 13 when he came up. And this is embarrassing, but, you know, when his baseball card would come out of the pack, we would jokingly call him Sperm Winningham. I probably shouldn't admit that in person. But, you know, that brings to mind another thing, which is to what extent are teams using these kinds of systems internally? And I know there's some consulting that goes on between publications like BP and like Fangraphs and the teams, but almost all the teams all the teams, I think at this point, at least have some kind of a analytics department. And I assume they have proprietary versions of this or they've licensed versions of this. Because one thing that I only know anecdotally from my own observation, but I suspect is true, is that things like the draft are becoming more rational. And that there are fewer outliers because, you know, Herm Winningham was drafted like four times and he was always a high draft pick and he didn't sign each time. But he was always a first rounder kind of guy. And of course, he wasn't that kind of talent in the majors. And I feel like the payoff is getting better. So I wonder if on paper, in addition to scouting, now we're seeing teams do projections for kids that are compiling numbers in high school and college.
I couldn't say at high school level, but I do know that teams do have their own proprietary projection systems. I know some of the teams that still subscribe to subscribe to the Zips data. I can't really see. I'm in a difficult position where I have a real conflict of interest because I'm a writer and I'm a data guy. Right. So I can't actually talk about things with teams like that. I can sell data that I have no insight to provide and no opinion. So it's hard to tell exactly what they're doing because they're not going to tell me exactly what they're doing, but I get the impression that teams that use Zips data also have their own projection systems, and it's just a case of that they want multiple opinions from projection systems and don't want to rely on one thing. But I think most teams at this point do have something like that.
Is there value in kind of taking the average of the projection systems and doing it that way, or are you really kind of throwing a lot of apples and oranges together in the bin?
I think there is value in doing it. If you look at people who have combined, say, Zips and Pocota and Steamer, those projections tend to be really good when you combine all of that. There's kind of the wisdom of crowds. When you consider that teams are paying $100 million for a free agent, having multiple data opinions on a player is a good thing to have. It doesn't cost them that much relative to what their risk is. And I think, you know, you have multiple scout players, so multiple data systems, multiple projection systems with different approaches also quote unquote scout players. Just they scout their numbers. So I do think there is value to it to teams.
So just to back off the nitty gritty of projections and stuff for a minute, how does a fellow get to be a pro analyst and a ESPN contributor? Where did you start with all this, and how do you get to where you are now?
Well, every path is different, and the way I did it, I don't think it's this exact way that someone else could do it today. Also, because some of the places I was at don't exist anymore. I was brought up really as a teenager on Usenet, which the people who are too young to remember it, there was this thing called Usenet news groups. They were kind of like the blogs of the 90s, or no, maybe Twitter of the 90s, because every internet service provider at college had a Usenet server, and you'd type something in and it would go to all the go to the same news group and all the other servers. So I'd type something in rec.sport.baseball at my ISP, and everybody who was in rec.sport.baseball would see that message. And that's kind of what internet sabermetrics was in the 90s. It was centered first around the Usenet crowd. I was one of the young ones at that point. I'm not one of the young ones anymore. it makes me feel really old, because I started reading Usenet in 1994 during the baseball strike, because I was, you know, teenage kid, baseball nut, and now baseball is gone in August all of a sudden. So I went there as kind of an outlet to read people talking about baseball. I didn't start contributing actively for like another year and a half till really, I guess, 96 and then into 97. And that's the crowd I grew up with and kind of came of age with. And there are a lot of names that people are still going to note, like the Baseball Prospectus founders, Voris McCracken, Sean Foreman of Baseball Reference, Keith Wilner of BP and the Indians. So there are it was a real, you know, proving ground sabermetrically for people at that point. That's where the industry was. And then after Usenet, I started contributing to a site called Baseball Primer, Baseball Think Factory, and that's where I really got going developing projections. And then I was happy there. I kind of refused full-time media jobs until there was a situation I really liked, and that came along at the end of 2009 when I was asked, hey, you want to write for ESPN? I said, sure. So that's kind of how I got there, but I don't know if someone could do it the same way that I did. I'm still not quite sure how I did it.
A lot of stuff happens by accident or is just fate. And we were talking about this a bit before we got started, but even those BP founders, they didn't know each other personally. They just met through that medium, the Usenet medium. And Gary Huckabee said, hey, let's just do this for publication instead of giving it away in this news group. And the rest is more or less history.
And we all kind of have that same, you can tell an old Usenet person, because we all had that same kind of snarky edge to it. Like Keith does, I do, Christina Carl does, because people who become analysts today when they're young, they're going into an industry where their contributions are already widely respected. And in the 90s, nobody in baseball really gave that much notice. I mean, there are obviously some exceptions, but the overall trend was that front offices were made of old players, people who are friends of the ownership and cronies and so on and so forth. And we were not respected at the time. So we had a little bit of edge that outsiders get. Now we've all kind of become more civilized. The whole Moneyball thing, that really kind of made us all respectable. And we've kind of all moved on and mellowed a bit. But there's always that little bit of snark that we just grew up on, I guess.
Well, like you said, there was a reason to have the chip on your shoulder. And I mean, I can remember back in those days having so many arguments with editors and when I was first getting started trying to explain that, like, no, RBIs do not indicate anything about a player's value. You got to understand me about this. And I remember one editor saying, but you don't understand. You know, the player took it upon himself to drive in that run. I said, no, he was hitting. There was a guy there who took it upon himself to get on base. The neat thing is, Dan, and since you have this perspective, I can kind of exult with you. We won. You know, like,
yeah, that's,
there was a war going on a war is a terrible way to say it, but there was a kind of an intellectual struggle going on. And once Moneyball came out, it kind of brought it all out to the surface. But even then, there were a lot of retrograde thinkers And just over time, what was out of the mainstream and people like us were advocating for these points of views, and we were all really kind of disciples of Bill James, I would say is fair. And then trying to carry that ball further, you know, that what was out of the mainstream is now mainstream. And so the things that we would say then that would surprise people, like that point about RBIs I was just making, I now think don't need to be made, or they don't need to be made as often, because especially I see this in the younger generations of writers, they just come equipped with that as if they were born with this a priori knowledge of sabermetrics.
Yeah. I mean, you see a lot of the sabermetric fights now. Now we fight over with people about things like the exact construction of wins above replacement and, you know, predictive versus descriptive, like for using things like FIP in war. It's like you tell people like, no, these are the fights we're having now. 20 years ago, we had to fight about convincing people that on base percentage was good. that's what we had to fight about. We OPS wasn't widely accepted 20 years ago. Now it's like too simple for people. It's like, no, we couldn't even get people to agree on base percentage and slugging percentage. Those were the rudimentary fights we had then. And so it's kind of weird when we have one of those retro fights now, when someone will talk about on base percentage, like, it's like, this is 2018. We're really having this fight now.
Steve here, endorsing Paul Revere and the Raiders' point of view that we shouldn't take it so hard, and that we'll be right back after these words from our sponsors. Well, I do think that there's kind of an argument, not about on base percentage necessarily, but it goes to the different war formulations also, and to what degree we really trust defensive statistics because they feed into war so much. The thing is that in the old days, if we had a player, we had two players and one had a 350 on base percentage and one had, I don't know, a 310 on base percentage, it was very easy to dismiss the latter guy. But now we can say, well, the 350 guy is worth minus five fielding runs on a season, but the 310 guy is a defensive wizard. He's, you know, one of the best shortstops in the game, and he's worth plus 15 runs every year. And so maybe those things start balancing out. And I don't know the answer to that. It seems like from a statistical point of view, the way that we construct these things now, that they do start to balance out. But I'm an end user. You're somebody who understands the inner workings of that more than I do. So, I mean, is that a fair way of saying it? And have we come to the end of that debate yet?
I think the debate always happens. I think on some philosophical level, it's best to kind of think of war not as a statistic, but as a general philosophical concept of a summary of a player. Because I would argue that war has always existed. It's just never explicitly existed. There's always a point where someone has to make a decision saying X player is better than Y player. And when they make that decision, they're making it based on something. And that something might not explicitly be war. It'll be some kind of combination of things or just, you know, triple crown stats plus defensive reputation. But on some level, when you're choosing between two guys and saying one guy is better, you're saying there's some war or some kind of comparison in which that player is better at. Now, we've obviously refined the concepts quite a bit, and there are still some issues because, for instance, defense is quite volatile. I tend to argue that if we're going to use one-year defensive data, we should regress it heavily just because it's hard to say a guy is truly a plus 25 defensive guy at a position based on, say, one season. So I do have issues with that. I think we'd be a little more conservative about how we apply defensive war simply because of that error bar. But I think we're mostly on the right track. And I think a lot of times we're disagreeing over smaller issues and probably agree on a lot more than we disagree.
With something like the defensive stats and when a guy does jump up and have like a plus 20 season. Now, there are guys like, say, Andrew Jones who had them year in, year out. But is there also like you have to control for the distribution of batted balls, too, don't you? Because, I mean, some players may just have more chances than others.
Yeah, it's one of the errors in defense. One of the nice things about the projection standpoint is that Zips does make conservative estimates of defense. You don't see guys projected to be at plus 25 or negative 20 or something. So there's actually less defensive volatility in the projections than in the reality, which is kind of a weird paradox.
Sometimes when I'm on Twitter and I'm talking about things that I am educated in as opposed to baseball, and somebody will say, stay in your lane or stick to what you know, I will say, I did not major in baseball. I majored in other things, and these are the things that I'm commenting now. So when you see me talking about history or politics or whatever, that's actually what my background is. I assume you too did not major in baseball, but that you are exploiting your education in other ways.
Yeah, I majored in mathematics. The weird euphemism, mathematical science, which sounds like just like a weird description. You major mathematical science. That's like sanitation engineer or something. But no, I was a math major, so I am using a lot of concepts I learned and some I had forgotten in college. I wasn't exactly, you know, I'd be more in Animal House than the Dean's List. Let's just say I did a lot more drinking than studying in college. But I did pick up some along the way of my education, and I kind of got myself caught up on the things I forgot as I need them. So I do have a background there. But one thing is nice about, because it used to be when people argue with an appeal to authority, I hate that kind of, you know, argumentative fallacy. But 20 years ago, I couldn't win that kind of argument. I couldn't win an argument from appeal to authority. But I can do pretty good now. When someone says, well, you're not X, I'm like, you know, you want to know how many teams I've consulted for? You know, I write for ESPN. I don't argue in an appeal to authority, but if that's where you want to go, I can totally kick your butt now. So that is kind of nice. I can say that I'm a baseball expert.
Decades ago, somebody in the military wrote Casey Stengel criticizing his managerial moves. And Casey wrote him back and said, oh, yeah, if you're so smart, let's see you get out of the army. And similarly, yeah, I mean, one should not appeal to authority as an argument. But as with Casey's response and as with your response just now, there are times when people, and I don't think I've done this publicly, I've certainly thought it, but when people have said, you're so stupid when you wrote this thing about the Mets or the Brewers or whatever, and anybody could write better than you, I always want to say, if that's true, why aren't you doing it? Like, yeah, nobody gave me permission to do this. I just started pitching things at people and have fought very hard to have the little piece of turf that I sometimes don't even have and have to reclaim it. And that, so, I mean, if you want to argue that way, fine, but at least be able to kind of point your own way.
Yeah, it's the thing about, you see that a lot with the projections too. People say, oh, the projections are just average some seasons and slaps a coat of paint on it. Anybody could do that. I'm like, well, why don't you? If you could project better than me, and if you could also write better than me, I have a pretty cool job. I hang out in clubhouses. I'm eventually going to vote for the Hall of Fame. If you could do this, you totally would be doing it.
That's exactly right. So going back to studying math, and for that matter, appeals to authority, when you developed Zips, did you, as Newton said, stand on the shoulders of giants, or to what degree did you invent it from scratch?
I would say I pretty much invented it from scratch. Obviously, some of the general concepts like starting with average seasons or looking at a cohort of similar players, I didn't come up with that. But really, the development of Zips was really like a year of just researching what stats are predictive, how are they predictive, how does doing X change the predictive value of this stat, and so on and so forth. It's a lot more, you know, the whole perspiration rather than an inspiration. Say if Sean Foreman, who is smarter than me, if he wanted to develop a projection system, he is smarter than me, it would still be difficult for him to beat me. Not because he's not smarter than me, because he is. It's that I've just put so much work, there's so much sweat equity built into the projections, just because it's a lot of work to make sure things work a certain way. I always have in versions of Zips that are a few years down the road that aren't the live ones, simply because I need more test data. I need to make sure that the improvements have value, because I don't want to make projections worse by making a change. So, I mean, it's a lot of work, and people don't always get to see that in the finished project, how much work went into trying to make the projections the best they could possibly be.
He also couldn't beat you because there's only a range of acceptable outcomes. I mean, as we said before, the systems are going to converge around certain outputs depending on the player, his history, and the kind of player he is. If you made up a system from scratch and it said that somebody with Juan Pierre's skill set was going to pop 50 home runs next year, it wouldn't be very valuable at all. It would have to come down around, you know, a 290 average that's all singles.
Yeah, that's a tricky part too. But as I say, if someone can make a better system, I think they will get some attention. Maybe they have an approach that will weed out a significant. I mean, they're not going to crush a projection system, but hey, if you have an approach that you think works, go with it. I've tinkered with all sorts of things, and it's really hard to just to wring out many gains at this point. People who are mad at me, I let them try.
And they do take it personally. And I'm sure you've had this experience. And I have too, because as the editor of that annual for as long as I did, I would go to book signings and other media appearances. And there would be people in the audience who, when we did the Q&A, and I mean, every year somebody would ask a question like this. They would say, in the book last year, you said that John Smith was going to hit 11 home runs and 450 at bats. Well, he only hit 7 in 485. How do you explain this discrepancy?
Well, first you had the people that think it's all kind of like people project based on grudges. Like, why don't you like him? Like what? That's not how it works. But projections have huge error bars. And one thing, if someone has a notion that projections are this amazing thing that predict with deadly accuracy.
Sorry.
If people have that idea, running projections will disabuse them of that notion fairly quickly, simply because, as I always say, the future is extremely foggy, and we're only trying to peer through the fog a little better than any other way. We don't have anything that could just cut the fog. We don't have any magic headlight that will just disappear, that will just make the fog go away. I can't think of the word, but we don't have that. We make educated guesses, and those baseline projections are the middle ground, that over-under number. We expect 10% of players to hit a projection level that we only predict them to have a 10% chance of reaching. That's a calibration issue. But any projection comes with the implicit belief that there's a good chance you're going to be wrong.
And of course, there are elements you can't control for, whether they're physical or psychological. There's always a guy who maybe he doesn't go on the DL for an extended period of time, but he plays 150 games and all year he's had a bad wrist. And so his numbers are down, and that's not the fault of the projection system. Alternatively, there's another guy who plays 150 games and he's having a vicious divorce going on in the background. And every time he goes to the plate, all he wants to do is go crawl into bed and pull the sheets up over his head, and he has an off year, and that's not the projection system.
Yeah, there's no way projections can deal with that. Like when you think of Segura and his child dying, a projection system can't deal with that. When a pitcher has Tommy John surgery, Zips can deal with that because it's objective data and it can work with it. But these personal issues, or just something as simple as a guy having, say, a mechanical change, it's hard for a projection system to kind of reach into that and pull out information. Projection systems go with what they have to work with. Sometimes it's good data, sometimes it's bad data, and it's going to be a source of error. And I always tell people that think of projections as the starting point for making a prediction about the future, not the be-all, end-all, ending point.
As you were saying, people take it personally. And one of the few moves that have happened this offseason that I questioned was the Mariners trading for Ryan Healy, because a first baseman with a 300 on base percentage is just not going to cut it. But I happened to see, I think you retweeted this, Carson Cistulli posted the Mariners, not the full projections because they're not up at Fangraphs yet, but just the diamond cutout with the war figures next to each player's position. And I looked down and there was Healy and there was this zero next to him. And it seems so stark. And even though I completely, just from my own analytical perspective, without the benefit of the numbers, agreed with that, I felt a little depressed to see it just sort of looking out at me like some octopus's eye, that zero. It just was like, okay, let's not have the season.
Yeah, but there's a really good chance that he could. I mean, I wouldn't say really good, but there is that chance that he could have a good year, or he could be even worse. I think my favorite example is on the team level. is that if you knew that every team was a coin flip for every game as a matter of fact, not just a guess, but you knew that as a matter of fact going in, you would still miss by 8 games or more on 20% of the league. And that's with perfect information. You're never going to have perfect information. Zips tends to be unimpressed with Healy's hit profile. It doesn't think that his minor league performance was as impressive as you'd expect an above average first baseman in the majors to have. And so it's not super keen on him in Seattle. But Zips could be completely wrong on that. There is that possibility, and it could be wrong the other way. I think of Mike Trout. Mike Trout, in his rookie year, Zips projected him to have a 4-win season. That was the highest projection that Zips had ever given a rookie. And people actually would tell me that's really aggressive for a guy who didn't have a good cup of coffee last year. And yeah, Zips was wrong, but in the completely opposite direction, when Zips was off by, what, 6 wins?
I was talking about this in my introduction to last week's show, actually. I was talking, of all things, about predicting war and things like that. It's once you have a non-zero possibility of something happening, we're good at saying, yeah, this is a 1 in 100 chance, so it probably won't happen. What we're not good at predicting is when that one actually does roll up. Once it's on the scale or the spread of possibilities, or as I said in that show, the 100-sided die, again, it may not be likely, but we can't control when that die will roll up that one. And that's when a projection, like you said, can go awry in either direction.
Yeah, I mean, another example I give is that when Zips projects players' batting averages, it projects very few players to have a mean projection of over 300. And people will say, so you mean Zips is projecting only one player will hit 300? I'm like, no, it's projecting that no player is more likely than not to hit 300. In fact, Zips would project, say, 25 players to hit at least 300 because not everybody's going to be at their mean projection. We know that things that have a 20% chance of happening should happen 20% of the time if, you know, you're calibrated correctly. But knowing when that happens is pretty difficult. And people have this almost Calvinistic idea that all these performances were preordained. Like if someone hits 370 in a certain season after hitting 300 every year of their career and hit 370, it doesn't mean that they were in fact likely to hit 370. It doesn't mean that it was some, you know, predestination that commanded them to hit 370. Just because someone does something doesn't mean that it was actually likely to happen.
I want to ask you also about projecting relievers because I saw your tweets about the Yankees bullpen.
Oh, Yankees.
Tell people what you found or are looking forward to with the Yankees bullpen.
Well, I'm sure you're looking forward to it a lot better than I am since I'm from Baltimore and I'm an Orioles fan. Zips gave the best ever projections to a bullpen to the Yankees this year. Imagine a situation where Robertson and Chapman and Betances and they all get like Legionnaires' disease and they miss the season. Say you chop off the top five relievers in the bullpen. Zips would still project the remaining portion of the bullpen with the best minor leaguers in the organization. They'd still project that bullpen to be above average in MLB. I mean, even going down to players like Jonathan Holder, Zip sees them as well above average in the pen. And so when I ran the projections, just to double check, because we were talking about errors before, just to double check, I ran like most of the top players again with other teams to make sure something wasn't weird with the Yankee Park factor. And no, they all just came out really just Zip just likes all the Yankee relievers incredibly.
So when you get to seasons that are samples of 50 innings or sometimes with lefty guys who are only pitching to one batter at a time, smaller than that, and like Betances could come in, walk the bases loaded, give up a grand slam in a third of an inning, and that could ruin his ERA for the entire year, basically. How confident are you in those projections or what adjustments do you make sure that you do get something that does correspond more or less roughly to what's going to be on the back of the baseball card?
Well, what happens is you don't really see it in the bottom line projections. But when I look at kind of, because Zips projects a lot of odds of things, when you go down the relievers, you see a lot less certainty in the projections. Like, for instance, Aroldis Chapman. This projects him to have a 2.41 ERA as the mean projection. But it also gives him more than a 10% chance to have an ERA plus under 100 in 2018. So the projection system, the model does realize that relievers are pretty erratic. I mean, you're looking at guys throwing 50 innings instead of 150 innings, and you're going to have that natural increased volatility. And you've seen it in relievers, some guys whose ERAs jump all over the place. It doesn't take that many bad months to ruin a seasonal ERA in an otherwise good season.
Did projecting, and your Angels projections are not up yet, but I've got to ask, did projecting Shohei Ohtani provide any special challenges to you?
Yeah. One good thing is that at this point, we have a lot of data from Nippon Professional Baseball, players coming over there, our players going over there. We have quite a bit of data. It's better than, say, Korea or Cuba by a long shot. But there are still challenges simply because there's still, compared to, say, AAA players moving to the majors, relatively speaking, it's still a small group of players. And there's probably some selection bias because teams only really go after players from Japan that they really, really want. And a team that has a player they really, really want probably believes they're going to be better than projections would. We're not really at the point where teams are getting many utility infielders or middle relievers, although that's increasing, but we're not at the point where ordinary players from Japan are coming over. So we could be in a situation where, say, we're overrating the quality of Japan based on their best players coming over, and it might not hold true with some of their second or third tier players. So we have a lot to learn about that. Obviously, Ohtani provides another interesting data point, but yeah, there's a lot of uncertainty around that projection.
And so I don't know if you want to give anything about the projection away, and I won't ask you to if you don't want to, but how confident are you that he'll be able to make this two-way thing work, at least insofar as the projections go?
Well, I did write a piece with the projections a few months ago, so it's not that big a secret. Zips likes him quite a lot. It thinks he's a three-win pitcher right now. Doesn't project very aggressively with the innings, just simply because he's been injured. And it thinks that he'll be an okay offensive outfielder, someone who's like maybe a little bit below average for an outfielder, but useful. And of course, because when people talk about good hitting pitchers, they tend to talk about pitchers that hit still pretty poorly, but just like in the realm of use. Very few pitchers hit as well as, say, Wes Farrell or Red Ruffing did. Even like someone like Bumgarner, if he were a position player, would be a pretty poor position player offensively.
Right.
But Ohtani, which is why I'm kind of sad he didn't sign with an NL team, because he'll be a decent outfielder, I think, but he won't be a star as an outfielder. And since he's not going to hit while he's pitching, the Angels don't get that much additional value for him. But of course, they get him so cheaply, they don't even have to necessarily use any of that to get value from him, since the whole thing where he gets paid the minimum.
Right. And if he takes some at bats from Pujols along the way, it feels weird saying that, but I mean, Pujols was possibly the worst player in baseball last year. So it's kind of sad to think about it that way. But if he pushes Pujols to the bench a little bit more, and I mean, there's that benefit. And I think they'll have benefit just as a drawing card too.
Yeah. What you find out when you look through the literature is there are very few players who actually can drive attendance beyond the wins they bring. People always say, well, bring in Eric Hosmer because he'll increase attendance. Like, no, he won't. Only very special players with a specific storyline around them have shown. Zimbalist did a lot of work about this early on, that only a few special players can really spike attendance beyond the quality or the perceived quality they bring to the team. And I'm talking like Fernando Valenzuela. There's evidence that he did that. Nolan Ryan, the McGuire-Sosa home run chase, those kind of special events and special type players that have that interest beyond and above the normal player, they can drive attendance. And I think Ohtani, as such a hyped player and such an interesting guy who can play two ways, I think he does have the potential to kind of boost attendance for a while above his actual win-based contribution to the team. So he could be one of those guys.
So my last question for you, and I will not interrogate you on your Hosmer skepticism, which has been in evidence on social media. I direct people to your Twitter feed to see that. But I share that skepticism with you. Why not give him 100 years? Why not give him 150 years? Last year, you did an article where you compared your projections for prospects with your ESPN colleague and mutual friend, Keith Law, his projections for prospects. Now, he doesn't do numerical projections. His projections are based on observation and talking to scouts and other executives in the game. So his are verbal. They're descriptive and are experiential. Yours are based on history and profiles and stuff. When you do a comparison like that, what do you learn?
Well, one thing I am always interested in is there's actually quite a lot of overlap between Zips and Zips top 100 prospects and Keith Law's. But then again, Keith is familiar with using data. He's not a scout only guy. And as minor league data gets better, I actually kind of data mine quite a bit from the minors, some play by play information. Obviously not the quality of the majors, but it does help. So you're going to, I think as time goes on and minor league statistics develop, we'll probably get closer to kind of a consensus between the projections and the player. I don't have it in front of me, but I think the first player on the Zips top 100 that wasn't also on Keith Law's top 100, I believe it was Luke Weaver.
Okay.
Around 30 somewhere last year. Zips had him 30th. Keith did not have him in the top 100. It's interesting to see the guys like that. I think projection systems tend to like kind of those high floor, low ceiling guys better than scouting types do. I think that comes down to just the human difference that when someone looks at a minor league prospect, the imagination takes hold and you want to think the guys who would just impress you and knock your socks off and that kind of magical feeling of seeing the next star. And so I think that people, when they scout, probably more favor the guys who are riskier, have a lower floor, but could truly be stars. While a computer system isn't going to be that excited about a player in the same way, and so we'll tend to like some of these guys who are not going to be stars, but just might be good players. Miguel Andujar was on Zips top 100 like at 60 or something, not because I thought he'd be a star, but because he had a good chance of just being a useful player.
Right. And I mean, Keith is looking for future stars explicitly. I think, along those lines, does Zips know about, say, pitcher velocity? Because there are a number of minor league pitchers we could point to who over the years have had, say, high strikeout rates on changeups and things like that. They're not throwing 97, 98, like a guy that you would rate at the top of the prospect scale, but how hard he's throwing is a key bit of information there. So if you have two guys who are the same age with identical strikeout rates, but one's doing it at 85 and the other's doing it at 95, you need to discount the 85 guy to some degree.
Yeah, that is a problem. I actually use some scouting data in the sense of velocity to try to use as kind of like a dummy variable for their velocity, because while Zips can do that with the major league players, you don't have that same kind of information in the minors. You can figure out some of what makes up a fastball hitter, a fastball pitcher, because they do have characteristics. The high strikeout rate. You can look at things like the home run rate, ground ball, fly ball, strikeout. Pictures tend to be a little different, but Zips can only guess at that without like the scouting information about velocity, which I do use where it's available as because it's data. It's might not be perfect data, but it's better than going with nothing. But yeah, I think there will be some players that Zips will be fooled at that can get out AAA hitters, but not major league hitters. But you know, every time Zips is wrong about something, I learn a little bit and Zips learns a little bit. And hopefully the next time that mistake won't be repeated. So it's always about just moving on to the next projection.
It's neat how these projection systems get personified. So we're talking about it somewhere between a person and Hal from the 2001 movies. And we did that with Pakoda back in the day, too. I doubt you think of it that way, but it certainly feels that way when we talk about it.
Yeah, well, I mean, Zips has been around now for 15 years. I mean, it's been in public since 2004. So people are familiar with it. They know Zips. There's kind of an a running gag or a meme, if you will, on Twitter, because someone wrote a letter to me once telling me that I should credit, when I quote Zips projections, I should credit my source for the Zips projections, because the person couldn't find the projection I was quoting on Fangraphs or anywhere, and wanted to know where I got that projection from. So there's an ongoing gag where people will ask me why I stole it from the Zips guy or anything. But I guess in a way there is kind of an anthropomorphization of a projection system. I almost kind of think of it as an entity as times. It's been very helpful in my writing career, because while it's not the only thing I do by any means, it's useful for a writer to have access to this kind of information, more than I even expected at the time.
And to have it ahead of everybody else.
Yeah, that's a nice benefit. I think I do good work. I think Zips is gives useful information, and I'm glad I did it. I think it really changed my life's trajectory into an area I did not expect to happen.
Dan, thank you very much for coming by. I definitely find Zips valuable. I enjoy looking at the projections as they come out every year and comparing them to what I have in my own uneducated mind for the players. And I enjoy following your work at ESPN. And for that matter, you know, back in the day when you were associated with Baseball Think Factory, Baseball Think Factory was very, very good to me as I was starting out, and always had good things to say about me, to the point that the one time that they didn't, you actually, you know, told me to buck up, which was a very nice gesture from, at that time, a relative stranger. So I greatly appreciate your coming by and talking with me for a while.
Well, thanks for having me.
Suffering sciatica, we've made it to the end of another episode. You can follow Dan Zimborski on Twitter at DSZYMBORSKI. I love all those consecutive consonants. As for me, you can follow me at Go Stephen Goldman. Why Go Stephen Goldman? Because at Golden Retriever, Stephen Goldman exaggerates my fetch skills, though strangely, not my ability to play dead. We have a sponsor now, but nevertheless, this episode is brought to you by the number 25. Our producer is Karcharodon Wimthistle. Our theme song, which you're hearing now and have in fact been listening to throughout the episode, was a co-composition of myself and Dr. Richard Mooring. You know, back when we were 17, a friend's mom said that we were not allowed to drive to the neighboring town to have lunch at Fridays. Rick staged a classic adolescent rebellion. I was very proud of him. He said, "You're not my mother." But in retrospect, given the quality of Fridays, the friend's mom was probably right. Well, assuming Dan doesn't project me for a -5 war season, causing me to be demoted to the 3i League, I'll be back next week with more tales and discussion from inside the infinite innings.